Today I want to talk to you guys about Nathanael. I called him Nathanael the true Israelite, Nathanael the guileless one. Guileless means innocent or not deceived. I label him that because the one scripture that we have of him shows that he is one who is not deceived. He seeks the truth. He questions things to examine if they're true. And I hope by the end of this sermon, we too align ourselves with being like Nathanael in this respect. That when we're told something, even if it's by me, even if it's by some other minister, that we examine it for ourselves. Question it. Is this what God's word says? If you remember when I was last here, 2 weeks ago, Philip brought Nathanael to Jesus. It was immediately after Philip was found by Jesus. So we have Jesus finding Philip. Think about it. How would you respond if someone you meet for the first time said to you, "Follow me"? Now, this is a loaded "follow me," so please allow me to explain. When you say "follow me," it means a literal "come with me where I'm going" in today's day and age. And it ends usually a short bit later. In this time period, it seems it was so much more, actually. If a rabbi, a teacher of this day and age, would say to you, "Follow me," it means be my protege, be my student. Come follow me, learn my way, and when I die, you will take over my work. There's nothing more, there's more to it, but it also means I'm asking you to leave your job. I'm asking you to leave your family behind. For us today, it means following Jesus is more important than those things. Needs to be our number one priority. A rabbi would say, "I'm asking you to leave your family behind and travel where I travel. Say goodbye because you may never make it back this way again to see them." It's not that you reject them, but as a disciple of a rabbi, you travel where they travel. You live where they live. And it's kind of this rabbi saying, "I'm asking you to follow in my footsteps." And if you think about it, think about the footsteps of Jesus. Where did he go? Persecution and death. We often try and sidestep this thinking, "I don't need to do that. That's a job for missionaries. That's a job for the preacher. Someone else, but not me." But it's not. It's expected by Jesus that Christians, those who follow him, are supposed to do. And you accepted this, "Follow me," when you decided to become a Christian. Jesus said to Philip, "Follow me." And this is a typical thing a rabbi would do. So every Jew was hoping by the age of 10 to 12, maybe a little bit older, to be chosen by a rabbi. They were waiting, ironically, hopefully like a kid, for Christmas. And here is Philip, likely much older than 10, finally being told, "Follow me." That's how loaded this was. But Philip understood that accepting this "follow me" means these things. It's an honor to be asked, perhaps the biggest honor a Jew could hope to have. Philip is no doubt excited, so he's so excited he's got to tell somebody. And so he goes and tells his friend Nathanael. Verse 45, Philip found Nathanael and said to him, "We have found him of whom Moses and law and also the prophets wrote." Seems to be the truth of Scripture mattered to Nathanael. Philip knew what would get his friend's attention, and he gave it to him. He used the Old Testament prophecy. The way Philip told Nathanael suggests that Nathanael knew the Old Testament very well, and here's as to why. In our Wednesday class, we kind of wondered, how much did the Jews know? Here's a bit of it. All Jews dreamed of becoming a rabbi. To a Jew, this was the highest position that you could aspire to become without being born into it, being born a Levite, or being born into the priesthood of the Israelites. Well, a rabbi would only take on a few pupils at a time, so they were very meticulous about who they picked. They picked the one they thought knew enough of the Old Testament. They would quiz them on everything they could think of. They would say, "Recite to me the book of Leviticus." Or they would ask, "How many times does this word appear in Leviticus or different books?" So, what do you do to study for these things? You memorize the Old Testament. They called the first five books the Law of Moses. And the rest of the Old Testament was known as the prophets. So they would reference it as the law and the prophets, the Jewish Bible, our Old Testament. And if your dad thought that you showed promise, he'd take you to listen to the rabbis teach so that you could learn. And hopefully at one of those times, you would be picked by a rabbi. Here's a bit of information as well. Just about all Jews, because of this, had the Old Testament pretty close to memorized, actually. They knew what it said, though they may not have known fully what it meant. And Nathanael is one of them, so he knew the Scriptures. Likelihood, Philip and Nathanael had come to the wilderness to hear John the Baptist, because he was one of the rabbis, if not one of the prophets. It's interesting the things that Philip does not tell Nathanael, though. He doesn't say, "I found a man who has a wonderful plan for your life," or "I found a man who will fix your marriage and your personal problems." He didn't appeal to Nathanael on the basis of Jesus might make Nathanael's life better, but simply Jesus as the fulfillment of the Old Testament prophecies. It would be a little like waiting for Christmas to a Jew. Waiting for this thing you've heard your whole life. Waiting for someone to pick you. He pointed him out as the Messiah, John the Baptist did. And Philip pointed to him as well and said, "This is the Messiah." The Messiah means God's anointed one. We wonder, why do they get confused? Here's a little bit of that piece of the puzzle too. This term anointed is just about solely used to identify God's chosen kings. Think about it, King Saul was anointed. David was unwilling to kill Saul when he had the chance because he was God's anointed one. King David was the next king, and he was the anointed one. He was God's anointed one as well, and no wonder the Jews were so confused. They're told, look for God's anointed one. This is their reference point. So they're looking at the Scriptures like this, and they see this is what the Anointed One does. And then they come to Scriptures like Isaiah's Anointed One, this suffering servant, and they're confused. They don't know how to handle this. What does this mean? Is this a literal thing, or is this a figurative thing? None of the other Anointed Ones did anything of this. I don't know what to do with it. And this is why people would quit following Jesus as well, as when he would tell them, "I'm going to be crucified." I don't remember that being what one of the anointed ones is supposed to do. They're supposed to be kings. That's not what an anointed one does. Maybe he's not the one. And so they'd walk away because they heard that. And that's not what the other anointed ones did in the past, really. But Isaiah foretold this is what the one would do. Now, at this point, Nathanael had not heard any of those statements of, "I will be crucified," yet. But notice the apostles, with the exception of Judas, were truth seekers. Before they met Jesus, they were searching for the Messiah. Their hearts were open to truth and hungry for it. When Nathanael went to Jesus, he was able to recognize Jesus because he had a clear understanding of the Scriptures, what they said about Jesus. He knew the Old Testament prophecies. Nathanael did have some problems, though. He was human. And with human, we oftentimes have prejudices. Verse 46 says, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" This is his response to, "We found the Messiah." Can anything good come out of there? He could have said it a number of different ways. He could have said, "You know, Micah the prophet said that the Messiah would come out of Bethlehem, right? Not Nazareth." Or, "But Philip, the Messiah is identified with Jerusalem because he's going to reign there." Not Nazareth. But the depth of his prejudice rings through as he chose, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" It was not a rational or biblical objection, just a sheer dislike. Remember, Nathanael was from Cana, and he's talking about it looking down at Nazareth, looking down on them. Frankly, Cana wasn't that great of a place either. It still to this day is unexceptional. Cana was off the beaten track. You had to go out of your way to go to it. I don't know how well you guys can read this map here. You had to go out of your way to go to it. Well, Nazareth was at least on one of the crossroads, really. It was a crossroad you could go on your way with. One of the main routes going north between Jerusalem and, shout out, Lebanon, passed through Nazareth. But no one ever passed through Cana, It was something you had to go out of your way to get to. Cana was a side trip from just about everything. Nazareth, though, it was a rough town. Its culture was largely unrefined and uneducated in comparison to other places. The Judeans looked down on the Galileans, but even the Galileans looked down on Nazareth, the Nazarenes. Nathanael, though he came from an even more lowly place, was simply echoing the Galileans' general contempt for Nazareth. This was the kind of regional pride that might make someone from Philadelphia look down on someone from Pittsburgh. Here again we see that God takes pleasure in using the common, weak, and lowly things to confuse the wise and powerful. It was inconceivable to Nathanael that the Messiah would come from a tacky place like Nazareth. Simply, Nathanael could not see that anything good can come from such a place. Prejudice is ugly. Prejudice eliminates the ability for people to know the truth. As a matter of fact, much of the reasons the Jews rejected Jesus as the Messiah is because of prejudice that they had built up. The Jews didn't believe their Messiah would come from Nazareth either. It was beyond them to believe that the Messiah and all of his disciples would come from Galilee. The Jews mocked the apostles as uneducated Galileans. John 7, verse 52, the Pharisees taunted Nicodemus, saying, "Are you also from Galilee? Search the scriptures, for no prophet has arisen out of Galilee." By the way, that's not actually true. Jesus was rejected in his hometown due to some prejudice. Because he was nothing more than Joseph's son, the carpenter's boy, they looked down on him, remembering he's just that young boy that we saw grow up. The entire synagogue in Nazareth, his own synagogue where he had grown up, were so filled with prejudice that after he delivered one single message, they were ready to throw him off of a cliff. Prejudice skewed their view of the Messiah. John Bunyan understood the danger of prejudice. In his allegory, The Holy War, he pictures, and this is a lot of irony, hopefully you'll see, the forces of Emmanuel coming to bring the gospel to a town called Mansoul. They directed their assault on Mansoul at the ear gate, because faith comes by hearing. But Diabolos, the enemy of Emmanuel and his forces, wanted to hold Mansoul captive. So Diabolos decided to meet the attack by stationing a special guard at ear gate. The guard he chose was one old Mr. Prejudice, an angry and ill-conditioned fellow. According to Bunyan, they made Mr. Prejudice captain of the ward at this gate, the ear gate, and put under his power 60 men called deaf men, men advantageous for service at the ear gate. And that's a very vivid description of precisely how many people are rendered impervious to the truth of the gospel because of prejudices that are built up. Their own prejudice renders them deaf to the truth. Men's ears are closed to the gospel because of many prejudices: racial, social, religious, intellectual. We oftentimes think because they're different, I don't want to listen to them. Satan had stationed at the ear gate everyone he could, Mr. Prejudice and his band of deaf men, for the purpose of being the most effective. In reality, a lot of people have prejudice and don't realize it. We draw prejudiced conclusions about individuals, classes of people, whole societies because of what we think we know about them. Nathanael, like the rest of us, had that bad tendency. His prejudice caused him at first to be skeptical when Philip told him that this is the Messiah, that he was from Nazareth. Fortunately, his prejudice wasn't strong enough to keep him from Christ. Verse 46, Philip said to him, "Come and see." Prejudice is a feeling-based thing. It does not necessarily reflect the truth of the matter. Some of the remedy of prejudice is an honest look at reality. The "come and see," come and find out. See if what your prejudices are and if they're really true. And Nathanael went. Fortunately, his prejudiced mind was not as powerful as his seeking heart. Probably the most important aspect of Nathanael's character is expressed from the lips of Jesus. Jesus knew Nathanael already, and his first words upon seeing Nathanael were powerful to who Nathanael really was. He said, "Behold, an Israelite indeed, in whom is no deceit." Can you imagine a more wonderful thing to have said about you out of the mouth of Jesus? It would be one thing to hear at the end of your life, well done, good and faithful servant. You were indeed a Christian, a genuine Christian. But to have that said at the beginning, how would you like Jesus to say that about you from the very start? This speaks volumes about Nathanael's character. Certainly he was human and had his faults, but to have this said about you by God, Jesus refers to him as an Israelite indeed. This word indeed in the Greek is alethos, meaning truly genuine, authentic. He was an authentic Israelite, the way an Israelite should be, the way that God imagined it to be. This was not a reference to a physical descent of Abraham, not about being born an Israelite. He was linking Nathanael's status to a true Israelite to the fact that he was seeking God, the way that God meant for his people to be. Matthew 7:7 says, "Seek and you will find. Be a true seeker." For the most part, the Israelites of Jesus' day were not real because they did not seek God. They laid claim to they were Israelites because they were born as Israelites. But they were phonies. They lived life with a mask of spirituality, but it wasn't real. So they were not genuine spiritual children of Abraham. And we can fall into this too. I was born into a Christian family, so obviously I'm a Christian, right? That doesn't make you a Christian just because your parents were. Romans 9:6-7, the Apostle Paul says, "For you are not all Israel who are of Israel, nor are they all children because they are the seed of Abraham." Romans 2:28-29, he writes, "He is not a Jew who is one outwardly, nor is circumcision that which is outward in the flesh, but he is a Jew who is one inwardly, and circumcision is that of the heart, in the spirit, not in the letter, whose praise is not from men, but from God." Circumcision, he's saying, is it's got to be something that you are, something that you practice, not just something physical like a mark. Here was an authentic Jew, one of the true spiritual offspring of Abraham. Nathanael was a true disciple. He was a true Jew, as he has said. This is very unusual, and it was particularly rare in the first century Israel, because remember, Jesus indicted the entire religious establishment as of his day as being hypocrites, of not really being followers of God as they should be. John 1:48, Nathanael said to him, "How do you know me?" It seems Nathanael is still questioning if Jesus was the Messiah. Not really questioning Philip or the scriptures, but just this man who came from Nazareth. He didn't seem to fit the picture of what Nathanael thought would be the Messiah. And now Jesus had spoken to him as if he knew him and could even see inside of his heart. Truthfully, Nathanael seems to be just trying to come to grips with what's being said. "How do you know me?" He might have meant, "Are you just trying to flatter me? I mean, this is a statement of trying to make me feel good here. How could you possibly know what's in my heart?" And Jesus answered him in verse 48 and said to him, "Before Philip called you, when you were under the fig tree, I saw you." This puts a whole different spin on things. This was not just flattery, it was omniscience, the all-knowingness. Jesus wasn't physically present to see Nathanael under the tree. Nathanael knew that. Suddenly he realized he was standing in the presence of someone who could see into his very heart with an omniscient eye, an all-knowing eye. And that was enough for Nathanael. Verse 49, he answered and said to him, "Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel." John's whole gospel is written to prove to us that Jesus is the Son of God. John's first words are powerful, a powerful declaration to Jesus' deity. "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." Every point in his gospel is designed to prove that Jesus is the Son of God. So when Nathanael saw proof of Jesus' omniscience, he recognized him as the promised Messiah. the Son of God, the King of Israel. In verse 50, Jesus answered and said to him, "Because I said to you, I saw you under the fig tree, do you believe? You will see even greater things than these." And he said to him, "Most assuredly I say to you, hereafter you shall see heaven open and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man." He affirmed Nathanael's faith and promised him he would see even greater things than what he had just witnessed of Jesus' omniscience. From here on out, everything he would see would enrich and enlarge his faith. In the Old Testament, Jacob had a dream that there was a ladder set up on the earth and its top reached to the heavens, and the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. Jesus' words to Nathanael were a reference to that Old Testament account. He was that ladder, those steps that were going up. In other words, Jesus is the ladder that connects heaven and earth. That's all we know about Nathanael from the Scriptures. Early church records record that he ministered to Persia, India, and took the gospel as far as Armenia. There's no reliable record about how he died. There's one tradition says that he was tied in a sack and tossed into the sea. Another tradition says that he was crucified. By all accounts, he was martyred like all the apostles except for John. What we do know is that Nathanael was faithful to the end because he was faithful from the start. Everything he experienced with Christ and whatever he experienced after the birth of the New Testament church only strengthened his faith because Jesus said, "It is even better than what you've seen." And Nathanael, like the other apostles, stand as proof that God can use something so lowly, something so common, from the most insignificant of places and use them for his glory. So today, do you feel common? Do you feel that God doesn't use you, can't use you because you're so unspecial, really? God says, "I want you to be authentic Christians, genuine Christians." The invitation's open today if you want to be that authentic Christian. If you want to say, "I haven't been that authentic Christian, but I want to renew my desire for that," the invitation is open to come forward as we stand and sing a song and express what your need is. Please come forward as we stand and sing.